Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the CampCast. I'm Jason Fallgerber. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. We have a man who has worn almost every hat you could possibly wear in the Menominee universe, Steve Ehrlich. I just got back from a trip to Denver and Boulder, where we connected with a lot of our Colorado area campers, met some new families, and I was lucky enough to sit down with Steve in person to record this episode. Steve has been coming to camp every year, every single year in some capacity, since 1959, and he helped start the Nate Wasserman Camp Fund and has been the commissioner of Fantasy Camp since its origin, which he also was a part of. And now he's basically the de facto head of our alumni network, taking the lead on our 100th anniversary, which is coming up in a few years. We talked about how camp has changed and evolved over the decades, what Nate Wasserman was like, stories about camp legends like Al Lewis and Bob Bender and Kaz and Jim Buzz Wyeth, where a lot of our traditions, sayings, games, and songs come from, the first ever Quagga competition, and much, much more. Towards the end, you'll hear the audio change for a few minutes. That's because after we recorded, we realized that we didn't talk about the Meat Man, and we could not... we didn't feel comfortable releasing the podcast without talking about the Meat Man and maybe the origins of that story. So we recorded a special segment in the car after the podcast was over, and I threw it in. So you'll hear that towards the end of the podcast. After 90 minutes, we both shared how much we wanted to talk more about and what we didn't even touch on, but this is a really great start. So I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Please enjoy this conversation with Steve Ehrlich. But first, as always, Miles Provis. All right, we're here, we're recording. This should be a good one. I'm really excited. We're in Denver. It's a beautiful day outside, but we are taking some time to stay inside before we go play tennis and talk camp. And I've got Steve Ehrlich with me. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
How you doing?
Welcome to Colorado.
Thank you for having me and hosting. We've played a lot of tennis. Yeah, it's been a lovely trip. We met some new campers in Boulder. But what we're here to do today is talk about camp from a perspective that not a lot of people get to have. And so why don't you start by telling everyone kind of who you are, your Menominee history, and yeah, as much of your background as you'd like to give us.
I'm a Southsider. I first attended Camp Menominee in 1959. I've been there every year, sans the COVID year, since then, in some way, shape, or form.
The longest streak, probably.
I think I have the longest streak.
Including Nate Wasserman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Nate would have been 28 until he passed away. So Nate would have been close.
So talk me through, well, first of all, yeah, give us some more background. Where'd you grow up? What did you do for work? Where are you at now in life?
Grew up on the south side.
Of Chicago?
Of Chicago. I actually went to Camp Shoreland. Camp Shoreland was in Calumet City, and it was owned by Lou and Corinne Wasserman, Nate's brother.
Okay.
It was a feeder camp.
It was a day camp?
A day camp for Menominee. I went there starting in 54 with Sachs, Backrack, Himmel, Jeff Schwartz, a bunch of the guys who
all grew up on the south side.
Grew up on the south side. They were either in the city or Homewood Fossmoor area. And then when we turned 10, all of us went to Menominee. We're in cabin 6.
So you started going to this day camp that was run by Lou. Was it a sports camp?
Yeah.
Okay. And was it, how did they recruit you for Menominee? Did they just ingrain, like, you went to this day camp and that means you went to Menominee, that's all it was.
Sure, Corinne, your folks signed you up with Lou and Corinne, and then when you were, turned 10 years old, Nate and Enda showed up at your house with the slideshow. And
do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So what was that visit? So Nate and Enda came over.
Sure.
Had the full slideshow.
Yep. They may have had a movie. I remember, I think there's the movie on the website from the 50s.
Yeah, the one on YouTube?
Yeah.
So that one was from, we'd have to look, sometime in the 50s.
It was early 50s, so it might have been that actual movie. I don't think it was a slideshow. I want to say it was a movie. That they showed an 8mm, 16mm.
Yeah, it opened with a man smoking a pipe saying, "Let me tell you about Camp Menominee." And then,
But this was a foregone conclusion. My dad had gone to Camp Menominee.
So when did your dad go?
My dad was in the 30s.
Okay.
He was a year behind Alan.
Al Wass.
And Al Wass had gone to South Shore High. Nate, after years at Marshall and a few other high schools, had moved over to South Shore High and was coaching there. That's where he coached Marv Levy.
Right. So that's such a great story. And we'll save some of that for the end, but we'll circle back to that, like Nate's legacy. But so Nate was a football coach. Was he a teacher?
I believe so.
Okay. And he, sorry, we got the windows open, so you might hear some outside noise. So how did your dad get recruited to camp? He grew up with Al. Were they friends?
No, they knew each other. Mm-hmm. I think from camp. I don't know that they went to the same grammar school. 1926.
Okay, and so he started going to camp 8 years later, 10 years later.
He was there, I bet he was there by the time he was 10. He went about 4 years, I believe.
When you started going to camp, that was a really interesting time. What did your dad tell you about his time at camp? Like, did he share the affinity for Menominee that you have and now that your son has? Like, was that there or was it, what was it, what did it mean for him?
Right. Sure, he talked about camp, had a great experience. He was a good athlete, enjoyed it. But I don't think he went much past 14 or 15. He was never a counselor there. Worked with his dad. Dad passed away early when he was in his second year, I think, at UW. Dropped out of school, went into the business, married my mom early, and I was born. Dad was 21, mom was 20.
Right, which is amazing. And you were saying how you would play basketball games against your dad. You were 16 and he was 37. And that's how, like, that'd be like me when I play with our CITs. And that's kind of nice. It's like you had a camp counselor for a dad growing up.
Yeah, we played a lot of sports together.
And then I know we touched on this before the recording went out, but when you were going to camp, there were some other people whose dads went, but not really in your age group. Like, it wasn't as prevalent as it is now.
No, there were some second generation people there. I want to say the Horwiches, who were a little younger than I am. Their dad, I think it's Stuart, went to Menominee. So there were multiple generations in my era also.
So you said Nate was born in 1901?
Yeah.
Okay. And so he started Menominee. We'll just get into the history of it before we dive into your experience. He started Menominee in 1928.
Rich Worsak, right, along with myself, have done a little digging. Rich was able to find a newspaper article talking about someone coming up to visit their kid at Camp Menominee in 28. So the name Camp Menominee was used in 28. And this was visiting the Camp Menominee site in Three Lakes.
Right. So there was a 1 year of...
1 year in Three Lakes.
Camp Menominee in Three Lakes.
Then it appears that Al Schwartz and Nate Wasserman parted ways.
Right.
Then for 1 or 2 years, Al Schwartz operated either on Big or Little Saint Germain, and then moved over, I believe, in 30 or 31 to the present site on Catfish Lake.
Of Ojibwa.
Of Ojibwa. Right.
So Al Schwartz, the guy who started Ojibwa, and Nate started a camp together in 1928, which was Camp Menominee.
As best we can tell, the right. name Camp Menominee was used in the newspaper in 28.
And then Nate left the Three Lakes location and moved to the Rhinelander spot.
That is correct.
Which is where they were for just under 20 years.
That is correct, on Bass Lake.
So your dad was at camp on Bass Lake in the Rhinelander location.
That is correct. What became Camp Mohawk, mm-hmm. when they sold the Rhinelander property to, and we have the gentleman's name, we have the deeds. It's sort of interesting. We have all this for the archives.
Right.
In, I believe it was 45, and we have the deed signed by Mrs. Comiskey.
Right. It is kind of cool to see the actual, like, signed deed of the land from the Comiskey family to the Wassermans for, yeah.
Nate and Edna bought the property in 45 and moved the camp over. In what we found was there was the hope that Camp Mohawk was going to be for the younger campers and mm-hmm. would become a feeder to Camp Menominee.
So they kept the Mohawk site and added on to the family with the current Menominee site.
They sold the Camp Mohawk site. They did not keep it. They sold it, but no,
okay.
That's not that we know of. Mm-hmm. But there was this, I guess, understanding that the younger kids would go to Mohawk and the little older kids would go to Menominee. I'm not sure if that was based on the capacity of both camps or what, but that was what we found in our research. And that lasted, I only think, for a few years. And then Menominee was open for business for kids from 7 or 8 years old up to 15.
Do you know what Nate did before he was 27 and started camp? Was he a
he was a teacher.
Teacher and yeah. a coach, like yeah. a football coach, yeah. and kept doing that.
He kept doing that while he was doing camp, yeah, which was typical. Because
did your dad ever talk to you about how World War II impacted camp at all?
No, he would have been done with camp by then.
Right.
But camp survived. It operated mm-hmm. during the war,
yeah.
which it was atypical to other organizations.
It started in the Depression, right? Well, am I getting my history right on this? If camp started in 28, didn't the Depression last like...
Stock market crash was 29,
right.
wasn't it? So yeah, they worked through the Depression.
Yeah.
And then made the move to Menominee right at the end of the war, mm-hmm. World War II.
So Nate's brother was your day camp owner.
Lou.
And Nate was your overnight camp director. Do you remember what Nate and Edna were like? Like, what were they like as directors?
They had big personalities. Nate was a coach and never came out of character. He was very supportive, but very firm. And you knew when Nate was unhappy. We used to kid that if he was wearing a yellow shirt, we would all stay away. He almost wore it as a warning sign to people, please don't mess with me today. But
it's like the opposite of, it's like his Tiger Sunday red. Like, you don't just stay out of my way when I'm wearing yellow.
But there are more than a few stories of being called down to the lodge. We used to kid that if your name came up, there was a package for you. You were in big trouble.
So was it, did they have a full-blown PA system?
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Did you ever have a scary moment with Nate? Like,
not individually, but as a cabin, yeah.
I'm sure.
We were acting inappropriately to a younger camper who was turning high school age, and we had high school fraternities, and we were, for lack of a better term, slightly hazing him. And Nate,
right, your intramural your high school intramural sports, you did it by, you made fraternities in high school.
The South Side yeah. high schools, whether they be public or private. Yeah, we had about 9 high schools that fed 9 fraternities, and I think there were 5 or 7 sororities.
So what do you remember from your first year and growing up at camp? What would you describe the camp culture like? What were the days like? How did activities work? Tell me about your time there as a younger camper.
Structured. Camp had senior counselors, almost all of whom were high school coaches,
right,
teachers.
So then, we're talking people in their upper 20s, into their 30s, into their 40s?
They seemed older to me, but right. most of them, I guess, were in their 20s, maybe early 30s.
Yeah.
Most counselors wouldn't last more than 3 or 5 years. They would get married, stop coming to camp. But these were young guys right out of teaching colleges.
Was it commonplace to grow up as a camper and then become a counselor right away?
Yes. We would have a CIT program, or initially when I was there, you were called a waiter.
Okay.
And you would help wait tables for the junior cabins.
When you were like 16?
When you were 16. Then probably when I was 13 or 14, that morphed into a CIT program. And Lloyd ran the CIT program, I think, along with Bob Bender. And we were in probably 3 different cabins during the course of the year.
Okay.
And we had sessions during rest period once or twice a week to prepare us to become counselors.
And then so as counselors, younger counselors, you'd be the junior counselors.
We were the JCs, yeah.
And the senior counselors were actual professional human beings. They were teachers and coaches that had full-time jobs in the off season, then would come back to camp to be cabin counselors.
They were cabin counselors. We had no counselors that were ADs that did not live in a cabin.
Everyone lived in cabins.
Everyone, Al Lewis, Don Walters, Lloyd, Mickey, everybody lived in a cabin.
Right, because the house that Steve built didn't exist. And the Wassermans lived in the lodge.
That's correct.
Right, with their family. Okay, so tell me about camp culture and a typical day and what just everything that you remember.
As I said, it was structured. We had a lot more classes.
Instructional activities?
Yeah, because we had coaches and they had the acumen to do instruction. So especially during the first few weeks, we had probably 4 classes a day.
Okay.
2 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, and then general.
Would you get to pick them?
There were core classes everyone had to take.
So what were those?
Those were swimming. Everybody had to take swimming.
Okay.
Now you might be doing water skiing or canoeing.
But you had to have waterfront.
But you had to have waterfront. You had to swim your laps. Everyone had to do 12 laps. So you couldn't go out to the raft
until you did your
12 laps. And you couldn't water ski until you did your 12 laps.
Okay.
And I was a late learner on swimming. Jerry Cody pushed me off the diving board, and I became a better swimmer.
You had a diving board?
Yeah, there were diving boards at the end of each pier.
Oh, that's great. We never had that.
And then we had, we just jumped off the raft. But no, we had diving boards.
So you'd wake up, would you go straight to breakfast or flag first?
I want to say,
because I would imagine it was more regimented.
We had flag raising first. Mm-hmm. We went to breakfast and we sat as cabins.
So you walk into the mess hall and you stand next to your chairs, or you get to just sit down?
No, we would sit down. At dinner, you would stand, because at dinner you would sing for health and
you
grace
would,
like, and daily
say
food.
Grace.
Yeah, we would say that before we. I would sit, and you would stay standing silent until Nate would say, please be seated.
Was there a dress code?
No.
Okay. You could always wear
I mean, at camp. Shirt, shirt, shoes, shorts.
So other than swimming, what else did everyone have to do?
Everyone played softball.
Okay.
Everyone played hardball. And everyone played tennis.
Okay.
So you had those core classes. Then you could pick archery, riflery, golf, track.
Did you have horses?
The horses were not on site when I got there in 59. We did have horseback riding, and the kids would be taken off site to ride horses. And that lasted maybe to 63, 64, and then they stopped offering that.
How'd you get up there? Did you take a train or did you ride a bus?
We took a train.
Okay. To Rhinelander, right?
To Rhinelander, or just outside Rhinelander. You would have dinner with your folks and go down to Union Station. Then they would put you on the train, and that's when all hell broke loose.
So it was just all, did they send staff down there to supervise the train?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yes, but it was, I mean.
So you just had train cars reserved of like 8 to 16-year-olds heading up to camp.
And it was multiple camps.
How long was the ride?
Probably we started rolling at 8 o'clock.
P.M.?
Yeah.
Oh,
you
wow.
went overnight.
Okay.
And then you probably got in at 7 or 8 in the morning.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I mean, once you pulled out, I mean, water balloons came out, squirt guns came out. It was just...
Oh, I'm sure they loved having you all on the train.
It was just unbelievable. I mean, it was hysterical. And the first year, you didn't know what hit you. The second year, you were ready.
What do you remember about your counselors? Like, who were some of the best cabin counselors you had, and what were some traits about them that...
Well, they were mature. They were coaches.
Were they strict?
They were firm. I don't know that I ever had any real strict ones, but I mean, you know, we would go back, we'd have cabin cleanup just like you have mm-hmm. today. There was no option of going to classes. The cabins were cleared and someone made sure nobody was staying in any cabin.
Right.
Everybody went to every class. That just was correct. The culture back then.
Yeah.
There wasn't...
Which is what we still do. Like, you can't opt out of Big Ten or like a league, period. Yeah, that's just not...
But so, they expected you to, clean up your area, do your cabin jobs, get out to activities, and participate. They were good role models. Not only the senior counselors, but the junior counselors. These were college-age guys, mm-hmm. Typically good athletes, good guys. And especially after you had been there a couple years, they were role models for you.
Could they smoke?
Oh, they were smoking on campus, yeah.
Although, like, just cigarettes everywhere.
Yeah.
That's such an interesting part.
I don't remember people smoking in the cabins, but I know people smoked.
Yeah. I remember seeing pictures of, like, counselors with their cabins around visiting day, and everyone just had a cigar or a cigarette. Did that stop when you were there, or that probably stopped in the 70s or 80s?
Not being a smoker, not having any friends who smoked. It had to have stopped in the 70s.
So who was the best counselor you ever had? And who, do you remember any that were just, that you hated and why?
We had a good cabin.
Yeah.
And so, you know, once you have a good cabin, the good counselors want the good cabin.
Sure.
So the first year, we had a rookie counselor, Bob Collister. Second year was Mike Calabrese. Then we got into basically the all-stars. We had Mickey Lyons. We had Lloyd Lindquist. We had Fred Dolan. And we had Don Walters. Mickey was the only former camper.
Okay.
So Mickey was probably the longest-running camper counselor.
Did you guys ever drive a counselor out? Like a guy that you didn't think fit Menominee or you didn't like him very much and just gave him hell until he left?
Not in our cabin.
In other cabins?
But as a counselor, I mean, we would come in during pre-camp and we almost have a lottery as to who was going to get fired because Nate would hire a couple extra, knowing that he would get rid of someone during pre-camp.
Okay.
And typically it happened.
So what, there were instructional periods all day and then there were generals. What were your competitions like? Who did you play against? What were the intra-camp stuff that you did?
The big competition was against Camp Interlaken.
Right, which is really funny that that was like the big rival.
That was the big rival until 65 when Kupcinet, I think, owned it. And that was Irv Kupcinet's brother, Joe, sold it.
What would you play against Interlaken?
We would play tennis, archery, and riflery. That would be the morning. And the afternoon would be softball. And the concluding activity would be swim meet.
And you were saying that camp was really specific about wanting to do stuff that you didn't do a ton of at home. So there wasn't a ton of basketball or volleyball. Like some of the mainstream sports weren't really prevalent at camp, right?
No, Nate believed you. There were certain things you would do at camp because you couldn't do them at home. So we did not play touch football at camp at all, although Nate was a football coach. Mm. There was only the half-court basketball.
Where was that?
By the garage. It wasn't a full court.
Like where the near court is? Wasserman Hall, the rec hall?
Yeah. And it was a half-court.
So what was where the Dunleavy courts are now?
That was the track and field.
Really?
Area. We had four tennis courts.
Okay.
The two more tennis courts were put in, I want to say, 70s.
Okay. Maybe late 60s. So at one point there were six tennis courts?
There were six tennis courts.
Oh, wow.
Then those got converted to basketball courts.
Right.
But they were initially two more tennis courts.
Well, it got converted slowly because when I was a camper, there were five tennis courts. The Dunleavy courts were the roadside was a basketball court, but the wood side was still a tennis court.
Yeah.
And then they built a basketball
court. It was six tennis courts initially.
Okay. So tennis was huge.
Tennis was big under Jim Wyeth and Bob Bender.
Was it a big deal to play Interlaken? Did you guys, were there, it was just this is what we did that day, or we got pretty competitive about it?
No, we prepped for it.
Yeah.
We would play Mohawk, the old Camp Menominee. We'd play them in hardball, I think. But there wasn't much inter-camp activities. We had Twilight League.
Yeah.
We had hardball Twilight League, as well as softball Twilight League.
Okay.
But we prepped for Interlaken. We did not have as many sports and as many teams. You basically only had an A and B team.
How many kids were at camp?
I was going to get to that.
Okay.
It was somewhere between 130 to 140 most years. So numbers-wise, you didn't need as many teams. But it was a big deal if you were a 10-year-old even making 11B.
Right. And do you remember how much it cost to go to camp for?
I want to say it was maybe my first year, $200 to $300.
Wow. And what was your paycheck your first year as a counselor?
Maybe $100.
Wow. See, that's different world. Like, that's every camp director back then had to have, like, you had a job at home, and then you also did this because you're not making a living yet.
Tips on Parents Weekend were a big part.
Okay.
I mean, if you got 10 bucks from eight parents, that $80 kept you going for the last 4 weeks, and the big tippers gave you 20.
So Interlaken was the big rival, and then you had mentioned to me offline that you used to play town teams in stuff, and then you had traveling tennis teams.
That was actually after my era, during my brother's era.
Okay,
they participated in Little League in Eagle River.
Oh, they like were a Little League team?
Yep, they would go in and play, and now I'm forgetting the name of that field there.
Fran Richter.
It was Fran Richter.
Yeah.
But they would play, but they dominated, so they basically threw them out of the league. And then Menominee would play the All-Star team and beat up on them pretty well. We just had the better athletes. I mean, we had more kids to choose from. I mean, Eagle River's population has stayed mostly the same, under 1,700.
Was there an awareness of the other boys' camps in the area, your Ojibwas and your Cahuagas? Like, did you all have friends that went to some of the other camps, or was it a lot more regional?
We knew more about Ojibwa. We knew that Nate and Al had been partners, and somewhere in the 50s, there was a dispute at the end of competition during a swim meet, and that was the end of competition between Ojibwa and Menominee.
So before you started going to camp, we used to play Ojibwa.
That is correct.
And then something happened. Because I would imagine those would be pretty competitive, given both Nate and Al Schwartz's backgrounds and their coaching and the people they hired and the philosophies of the camps.
It's my understanding, as Mickey would tell the stories, it was very competitive.
I would love to hear some of those. Okay, so then people always wonder about our Cahuaga competition. How far back does it go and when does it start? And now we're kind of getting there, right?
It had to be 66, 67. It started right after Interlochen.
So you went to Camp 59 to
73.
73. So were you a camper when the Cahuaga thing started, or you were on staff already?
I was on staff. That's where I think the last year was my 16A year, was 65, and we were playing Interlochen.
Got it.
Then I think 66, when I was a CIT, or excuse me, that would have been a JC, we started playing Cahuaga.
So what was that? Did that take a while to grow a rivalry? Was it a big deal? Or was it just a camp to compete with because we wanted that outlet?
It was a big deal. I mean, playing another camp, there was a rivalry, but obviously 7-8 decades has grown it into something a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm. And so when you beat other camps, when you guys had victories, how were they celebrated?
We didn't like it.
Right.
I mean, we enjoyed it, but Nate Wass taught us the importance of winning,
acting like you'd
and losing. You know, said, winning teaches you something about a man's character. Losing teaches you everything about a man's character.
Do you remember any other Nate Wassisms that stick with you? Maybe some will come up as we're.
Yeah, he was just a big force. He would he would grab you and firmly hold you around the neck and share his opinion with you.
As you're like grabbing you back and be like, let me tell you something, like always teaching, always coaching.
Yeah, he told me I should, you know, focus on one sport. You were up at camp, you played every sport.
Right.
You loved every sport. And I never got that. I ended up focusing on tennis. Mm-hmm. And Nate would actually come out and help teach tennis back in the day.
Is he a good player?
Nate had a great punch volley, good serve. And Alan played high school tennis and did very well.
Oh, really?
Alan was a good athlete. So was Nate. I mean, Nate would come out and play in our counselor games. Alan was a very good 16-inch pitcher, a good slap hitter, he knew what to do. He's a good athlete.
And you guys were all at camp for 8 weeks every summer.
There was no
anything else.
Exception. It was all 8 weeks.
So as far as consistent programs, I heard we still had Twilight League then.
We had British and American.
Okay. Was it the same? Like, what was B&A when you were?
It was a lot of field games. Message to Garcia.
Still there.
It was developed when I was there. I want to say it was Marv Gerber who brought that game to camp.
Okay.
The same guy who brought the song We Are the Green Team, a ragtime song, which most of the folks don't know, but one of the great green and white songs of all time.
So how many... We'll get there. So we had B&A. Was it two camper captains and there was a whole production to start it? Like they would capture Nate Wass or anything like that? Like, would you start things with a surprise or was it just like today we're doing British and American and here are your teams?
Yeah.
That was it?
The surprise really came because the camps back east would do those
would
things.
Would do the big breaks.
And
yeah.
I picked up on it through my wife, who was a camper for many years.
Right.
And other guys I met in college from the East Coast. And we would be talking about camp and color war. And they would talk about how two counselors were getting a fight or something. That's how it would break. We never had breaking. It was really... some of the first things we did to start Green and White was when we got Al Wass to go up in an airplane and drop tongs with either green or white tails on them out of the airplane.
So would you say that was the first kind of surprise color war break?
Yes. We told everyone that Doc Strub's wife had lost her wedding ring out on the golf course, got everyone on the golf course. Alan came by. They misjudged the wind. And most of them went into the highway, but that was the first green and white break.
Okay. And so what year was that? I love hearing about how these camp traditions, sometime in the 60s?
Sometime, I want to say that was early 70s.
Okay. Early 70s. So yeah, that's really interesting. So before that, it was just, okay, here's your teams. And we're gonna go. So what was Green and White like growing up, and what did it evolve into by the time you left?
Green and White was somewhat similar to what you have. The Sing started my first year in 1959.
Okay.
Before that, it was just all athletic activities, but they added the Sing as a component, and Lloyd and Mickey... Bob Bender, Jim Wyeth would help write the songs. And for a week or 10 days during rest period, you would work on those. And there was one counselor assigned each team.
Every year.
We had new songs every year, one new song for each team, and sometimes a new all camp song. But you would sing three songs, and it was a big deal. You worked hard on it. And
so right now, the four-song Menominee medley, the thing that we all kind of learn right away, is Menominee, Menominee, Hail Our Colors, Hail to Menominee, and Bright as a Sunburst. Were those four in place already when you were a camper? They were written throughout time.
Three of those were in place. Bright as a Sunburst, I plagiarized from Racket Lake Camp. I called my wife and said, give me your best song, because she was a counselor.
So you wrote
when I was
Sunburst.
A counselor. Racket Lake.
Racket Lake,
right?
Did.
And,
yeah.
And we just changed the words.
Got it. So we stole Bright as a Sunburst.
Yep.
Thank you, Racket Lake. And every year I realize what colleges inspire the other songs. I believe Menominee, Menominee is the Gophers.
Minnesota
fight
Rouser,
song.
Yes.
Hail Our Colors is Michigan State. Hail to Menominee, I think, is Colorado, because I was there last night, and they had, or maybe I'm switching those.
Michigan State is
Hail Our Colors.
Hail Our Colors. Yeah. Menominee, Menominee is the Minnesota Rousers. Hail to Menominee.
They were playing it last night when I went to the, we'll look it up
okay.
later. And then you all wrote different songs. Who wrote the Les Mis?
Les Mis was,
do you
I
hear
believe,
the voices
Glenn
ring?
Klein's dad wrote that.
Oh, really?
That was after my era.
Do You Hear the Voices Ring?
Yeah.
That's great. And then what other songs would you sing around a campfire?
John Jacob Jingleheimer
okay.
Schmidt.
Did you sing the Titanic song? Or
we always sang the Titanic song.
Was there an origin of that? Like, why did that become a camp thing? It just was?
It was when I got there.
Okay.
But we did a lot of singing. You would sing the camp songs. These other songs, when you would go in the rec hall, you would sing them a couple songs before movie nights, because we would have, you'd see half the movie on Friday night and half the movie on Saturday night.
Was it in like a reel? Like you had the projector?
Oh, we had a projector, 16 millimeter, yeah.
Went to the library or something and got...
Went to the library?
The movies?
No.
Where did they come from?
They would come in a big box. the mail guy would bring them in, and people would want to see what movie was coming. That was a big deal of what movie we were going to have on each weekend. And the mailman would bring them in a big box, and people would try to see what was on the outside. And normally, no one would know until it started rolling.
What, so the Sing was always accompanied by a piano when you were there, right?
That is correct. Yeah, Buzz did it, Marv Gerber, some other counselors, Tom Boguslawski.
And so you would learn the songs. See, that's why no one now can sing the songs, because we haven't had a piano player teach like the songs and rhythm for
you need decades. A piano player, and a lot of the songs we found them in the Megaphone are there. But there are a lot of Menominee songs that aren't being used. And then we used to do an all-camp play also.
Okay.
And we did parodies of Fiddler on the Roof was Counselor on His Back.
And that was just us. We didn't do it with a girls' camp or anything.
It
was just
an all-male cast.
Got it.
What were
some of the other ones? Were they musicals?
They were musicals, okay. Yeah. No, they were 8-10 song musicals. It was a big deal. Lloyd and I did a bunch of them, and I got to call Lloyd and see if he has any scripts. Maybe put your soon-to-be wife to work resurrecting the all-camp plays. But it was a big deal.
Maramita
would come over for them, but we did not have
We put on a show for Maramita.
Yeah, Maramita would come over and watch. And one of the shows was Abraham, which was a takeoff on Oliver, the musical. And we did a song to Anna Tefka, and it was Maramita, Maramita. And I won't say
the
words that we had in there, but it was funny.
I wonder when that stopped, because when I was a camper, the older kids did a show with Chippewa, and then we would put that on for the social, and it was really fun. And then that stopped, but I don't remember. We do all the skit nights now, each like small skit nights each night. Did you guys do those, like commercial night? And
yeah, we did all that. We had cabin sings that every cabin had a song,
right,
each year.
That you were like, you thought about it all year.
You had a few days.
Okay.
Not
so dissimilar to our song night.
No. And but no, we had skit nights, commercial nights, things like that.
Okay.
Miss Menominee night, which obviously
we did a like drag show.
Yes, we had breakfast with Randy Stein, who is a multiple Miss Menominee winner over the years.
Did people come and watch that, or was that just internal?
That was just internal. And we would have Monster Night.
Lennox had a version of that, of Miss Menominee. And then Maramita used to do it. And when I was a counselor, we would send over representatives to do it. Each cabin would like dress up one of the male counselors, but I don't think they do it anymore. Okay. Do you remember the moon landing at camp? Were you at camp when that happened? So walk me through that, because that's a fascinating thing.
July 1969,
yeah.
If my memory
July
is correct.
July 20, 1969.
Yeah. And we were sitting in the lodge. I don't think it was a color TV.
In the living room?
In the living room, because we rarely turned the TV on during the season. Mm-hmm. But they let the seniors stay up. I was a counselor at this time, and we watched the moon landing, and it was at night. And I remember watching, and then we all went outside and looked at the moon.
That's kind of crazy. Like, what an experience. I mean, more people watch that than most Super Bowl. Like, it's the most watched thing in that century. And the fact that you guys were all there, was there a lot of tension? Was there excitement? Was there like, was this something people were looking forward to, or did it just kind of happen at camp? How did like word get around about stuff when you were there? People sent up newspapers, or you found them in town?
Newspapers were delivered. Mm-hmm. So you would see newspapers. You would get Sports Illustrated and magazines a few weeks late. Sometimes your parents would try to stick sticks of gum in there, but Elaine was a hawk. She would be sorting the mail, and she was better than a dog sniffing out marijuana. She could find candy coming through in envelopes.
Who were the medical staff?
Doc Straub, Doc Shalowitz.
So Doc Shalowitz, is that Howard Shalowitz's dad?
I believe.
Okay. Yeah, Howard came back with his boys for a post camp and for resort.
Yeah.
A few years back. Kohlenbrenner? Or was that after your time?
After my time.
Okay. And Doc Miller started after
your
time too, and Kanaz. Okay, so how did camp change the most from when you started as a camper to when you What was your last year on staff?
73.
Okay. So what were the biggest changes?
We had started losing having PE teachers, teachers come up. They were starting their own camps, with their high school or programs. And they were starting to get graduate degrees in order to get more money.
Okay.
So we started losing them. It was very atypical to have the first or second year guys out of Chicago Teachers College or other local colleges that had teaching programs coming up to camp. The last wave of those were the Preebies, Bob Godotti, Ronnie Crabb.
So were you on staff with the Preebies?
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. And so their story is very unique because they were counselors. And then Larry met Nancy, who was the nurse, right?
Bernie.
Oh, sorry. Leo met Bernie, who was the...
No.
Yeah, Larry.
Yes, Leo.
It's Leo and Bernie, Larry and Nancy. Those
that
are
is correct.
The couples.
Yeah. And Leo met Bernie.
Yeah. And that's amazing. Like they... A camp romance. And now they still come back for post camp, like 40, 50 years later. Their granddaughter got married at camp 3 years ago. So it's a special thing.
They were, I want to say, how old are they now? About 81. So they're about 6 years older.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah. So sorry, you were talking about the staff because that's really important. So it was harder to get professionals, teachers, coaches to come up and be counselors.
So by the time I was, 72, 73. I was basically the senior counselor. So I had the senior cabin my last few years. There wasn't, Don Walters had left. Al Lewis was now basically in an AD. He was sleeping
what
in the lodge.
What cabin was the senior cabin?
Cabin 12.
Cabin 12. Because current cabin 13 wasn't there.
Cabin 13, what you call cabin 13
yes.
is cabin 15.
Okay. Was that there your whole time you were
that
at camp?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. Because at some point, the legend is it used to be on the other side of camp, and they moved it to be by itself over.
I have no knowledge of that. Cabin 13 was cabin 15, was there in 1959 when I got there.
14 and 15 there? Current 14 and 15.
Yes, the chicken coop.
No, that's 16 and 17.
Okay.
The ones that back up to the lake.
Okay, no, that was Jeff Schwartz's time. That came in the 70s.
Okay, so those cabins weren't there.
No.
So
we had 15 cabins.
So in current lingo, everybody, cabins 1 through 13 and then 16 and 17, and that was it.
That's correct.
No one lived above the rec hall.
No one lived above the rec hall. Right. No, that was ping pong.
Okay. And so what did they do about staff? Because I think this is a really, where did they find staff to replace the people that they couldn't hire?
It was all former campers.
Yeah.
It was college kids. They would go around and find kids that were wannabe coaches because that was a good thing to add to your resume. And we had the initial influx of foreigners.
Right. And so... You were there when we pretty much had our first group of international counselors that started a movement and a generation and a wave of international staff coming over to the United States.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was caused by the migration away of coaches coming to camp or better air travel or what. My guess is it probably started on the East Coast and then spread across the country. But
Who do you remember? Do you remember what year?
It would have been 67 or 68, whatever Spoage's first year was.
Okay.
I mean, Spoage, Stuart Duncan, those guys, and Chick Carvel.
So
Gordon
Allie
Short.
I think
he was our first wave. Yeah.
Amazing. And how many? Do you remember how many there were that year?
Five, maybe.
Okay. Was it a big culture shock to you all? I mean, you grew up at camp with just Americans and coaches and teachers, and now all of a sudden these guys from overseas who don't know camp culture or Menominee at all are coming over. Was that a hard transition?
It probably should have been, but it really wasn't.
Okay.
These were good guys.
Yeah.
And whoever might have prepped them, and I think it was some organization. It wasn't Al Wass going across.
But, and you couldn't do video interviews. You never met these people. You kind of probably saw a file with their skills and had to take a chance on.
Yeah, I think they used some type of service.
Yeah.
All the camps did, and then you would just get yours, so to speak. And there were women and men, and we were lucky. Not all, but most of the foreigners that came over were great guys. There were some that were one and dones. They didn't work out. It just wasn't a good fit for them or for camp. But some of these guys came back year after year
and sent their kids,
but maintain friendships. I mean, I correspond with Chick on a regular basis.
Where's he from?
Chick is from Swindon, England.
Okay.
But Ali and I write. Rich Warsek is in communication with Spowage all the time with Chick. I mean, these are friendships that have lasted a lifetime.
That's a really cool thing. When did Al Wass transition to, like, officially running camp?
I want to say it was mid-60s.
So you worked for Al. You didn't really work for Nate.
Nate was around, but Al had taken over.
What were the biggest changes between Nate and Al, like, in that transition?
Al delegated a lot to Al Lewis. Although Nate, even by the time I got there, Lloyd, Mickey, and Don Walters, I mean, they were very strong leaders in their specific programming areas. But by the time that I became a staff member, Al Lewis was the head counselor. And
Who was Al Lewis?
Al Lewis was a high school baseball coach from Granite City, Illinois.
Okay. Where's Granite City?
Granite City is just outside of East St. Louis.
Okay.
His claim to fame was he coached Del Maxville, who played for the St. Louis Cardinals. That was his star. And Al was a very competent baseball coach. But over time, he went from being the baseball instructor to being the head counselor.
So he started as a staff member. He was never a camper.
He was never a camper, no.
And he was hired. How old was he around the time? Like, he's older than you, or was?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, much.
Yeah, he seemed like he was 80 years old when I was there, but he was probably
in his
40s or 50s.
Did Al Lewis have a family? Did they come up?
Al Lewis had a son who was on staff for a while.
Okay.
In the 70s. His wife was up there, but not on a constant basis.
He must have been a pretty impactful guy.
Al had a lot of wisdom. He ran a tight ship. You messed with Al, and you would get the unwanted assignments.
Okay. So would you say he was a lot of the Woody of the day, like the kind of guy who he's running the show? Like Al Wasserman is the owner of camp, but Al Lewis was the guy that...
I would agree with that, yes.
Do you know when the field was named after him? That might be a question for Glenn. Was named after anyone until the 80s, right?
Names came with Glenn Klein.
Got it.
But the hardball field was on the west side of the service road where the soccer pitch is now.
Right. Old Al Lewis Field.
Old Al Lewis Field.
And the soccer pitch was where current Al Lewis Field is.
We sort of played soccer on that. It was not a regular soccer field.
I would imagine it became more prevalent as more internationals came and as it became more popular in the United States.
But we had a three-hole golf course. Mm-hmm. And that got upgraded with Chick Carvel and a few of the, he was a golf counselor.
And you had
a
lot more land. You had 110 acres.
There was more land on either side that Alan sold off to the Pitlick family on either side. But that wasn't usable land, but for campsites. It was not any fields.
Did you guys do a lot of camping and trips?
We did the Sunday night cookout.
Right.
Everyone, starting with the first Sunday you were there, made your campsite and used that campsite for the next 7 weeks.
Right.
But we had campouts every Sunday night. And so far as trips, the 7, 8, 9-year-olds would go on one-day trips to various falls and things like that, just one-nighters, I think up to 10. Then 11, you did a two-day canoe trip, went over to Lone Pine Landing on the Rainbow Flowage.
Yeah.
And then the big trip was the three-day trip to Rhinelander.
Okay. And that stuck all the way to when I was a camper.
And then the four-day trip, or then when you were 11 and 12 were canoe trips. 13, you went to the Dells. That was the trip when you were 13.
I love that these are still what we do.
14.
There's something to be said for comfortable consistency.
14, we went to Mackinac Island.
Oh, cool.
And 15, we went over to Minnesota for a baseball game.
So you didn't whitewater raft at
no.
all? Who ran the waterfront?
Don Walters was head of the waterfront, and Lloyd did canoeing. And trips.
Okay, I want to do a little bit of fast forwarding because I want to dive into kind of your legacy at camp after leaving. So you stopped in the 70s, 73
was my last year. 74, I came up to visit right after I took the bar exam.
Okay.
Literally between the bar exam and starting my job. So that was my shortest stay at camp of any year. That was like a 3-day visit.
So then how did you stay connected with camp between 75 and the late 80s?
Family camp.
Okay.
Yeah, we started going to family camp without families.
What do you mean?
The Saxes, the Zenoffs, the Ehrlichs. We would be in cabin 15.
Everyone had families and it'd be just you guys and your wives?
Yeah. And so the people who had families, we were wondering if, you know, it was like polygamy in motion, who was really with who, because we all slept together
in
the same
weird
cabin.
Couples that are in cabin 12.
And so we started coming and, we did that for years without kids. And we started having kids and, family camp was a pretty social activity when we got there in the 70s. A group of parents would be the host for an event every evening. I mean, these would be dress-up events, square dances. I don't want to say disco night because disco didn't come to the 80s, I think. But, I mean, there were...
But just full-blown,
nice events, decorations,
food.
Who
watched the kids?
The older kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they had 12-year-olds, the 12-year-olds would babysit the other. But every evening was an event.
So who was that post camp during that time?
The Benjamins had a whole group of people.
Were the preppies going yet?
No.
Okay.
No. It was a lot of the Benjamin era. There was the Parks family, the Benjamins. Well, Roger and Judy Feldman were there because Roger was not a camper. He was only a family camper who turned into a fantasy camper.
Oh, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, he never went to camp. His kids did, but he never went to camp. He went to Thunderbird.
All right, so you mentioned fantasy camp. So you're going to post camp, and now it's the mid to late 80s, right? And so talk to me about how fantasy camp was born and your involvement with it and...
Well, let me transition just a little
bit
back to family camp. So when the old camper counselors started having kids and we sort of took over family camp, we turned it into camp. So we started having green and white.
During family camp.
I mean, a lot of things that we did at camp became part of family camp, and that became... In many ways, like you, Father Son now was a taste of camp for the young kids. Family camp was a taste of camp.
Okay.
And that's what it was supposed to be, becoming a feeder for Miramita and Menominee by bringing kids up. But it was a lot less social in the evenings and more kid-oriented.
Okay.
During the days.
And then so then transition to, like, talk to me about the birth of Fantasy Camp.
Glenn, we were having an anniversary at that point. It had been the 60th, I believe.
Yeah, if it's 88, that would be, yeah, around there, 87, 88.
So we're having the 60th, and Glenn said, why don't, as opposed to just having a party in Chicago, why don't we put in a component before camp starts of having the alumni come up?
So when camp transitioned from Al Wass to Glenn Klein in 83, were you trying to be a part of that? Were you involved? Did you know that was happening? Was there a party that would have jumped in on it and left the legal world to run Menominee?
Well, Jeff Schwartz was the heir apparent.
Okay.
Initially.
Because he was the director.
He was the director.
Al's director at the time.
And he was planning to buy the camp. Then
Al Lewis had moved on.
Al Lewis, I'm not sure when Al had stopped coming, but okay. Jeff had gotten married and was ready to get out of banking and go into the camping business.
Sure.
So he was at camp, and I don't want to say, I'm not sure what year. It was in the 70s. It was the year of, you know, we called it the plague, when they had to send everybody home.
There was like a flu epidemic.
A flu epidemic, yeah. And the CDC had them send everyone home from Menominee and Maramita.
Okay.
For about 5 days. And that was just tough on Jeff. And he decided he wasn't going to go into the business. He, along with his wife, made that decision.
Okay.
So then a few years later, Glenn had the opportunity.
So were you, during that time, were you pretty still involved with camp, like at least with alumni stuff, and you were coming to post-camp and...
Just post-camp.
Okay. And then so, Fantasy Camp, Glenn said, was it Glenn's idea that you helped him organize?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we started going, and it was actually, I think we were just calling it alumni camp. My wife was the one who said, let's call a
That's
fantasy
amazing.
Camp.
Laura, secretly, like, no one talks about it, but she's got Bright as a Sunburst Fantasy Camp. She's got a lot of influence on the history of Menominee.
She was at camp more than I was.
Yeah.
More years. Her mom was head counselor at Racket Lake.
That's
so she was on site at camp, I think, starting when she was 2 years old at Racket Lake.
She's one of our unsung heroes.
She's put a lot of years in a camp.
So when they had the idea for Fantasy Camp, were you kind of did you raise your hand and say, I'll run it and organize it?
Yep.
Okay.
And there was no internet.
Right.
This was all paper and landlines.
Snail mail and phone calls.
And we had, I think, about 100 plus guys show up to the first one.
Really?
Oh, it was.
In 87, 88?
Well, we're at, 36 now? It's somewhere in there. It had to be 88.
Right. I think the 40th is going to match up with Camp's 100th. Well, no, it's actually one off because we didn't do it in
I think it was 88 was the first
yeah.
one.
Okay.
So it was 88 because I was...
Right. So this, I think, is Fantasy Camp 36. I think you're right.
Yeah. And, I mean, it was a lot.
You had over 100?
Yeah. It was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears trying to get everyone there. I mean, it was literally, I was on the phone. We wrote letters. I mean, and there was no database with this
right.
information. It was, I mean, we just finding people was a challenge. But we had a great turnout, and it was a ball. And we took the approach. It was going to be 8 weeks of camp in 3.5 days. And
did you know it was going to be an annual thing, or were you thinking maybe every 5 years or something like that?
We were just glad to get through the first year. At the end of the first year, we knew we wanted to do it more. But then numbers dwindled.
Right. Everyone was really excited to come back and do it as a reunion kind of the first year. And then ultimately, for a while, the numbers hovered between 30 and 60.
20 and 30.
Okay.
20 and 30. Then I think partly internet, partly age. the numbers started to grow.
Yeah.
And we started getting back to 60, and now we're normally about... Yeah, I think
we had 70 or 80 last year.
Yeah, we're about 80 every year now.
This year. Yeah, it's a special weekend.
But that first weekend, I mean, it was a ball. I mean, the Color War, Twilight League, a lot of short sheeting of beds. We did a great prank. The older guys canoed over to Pitlick's for cocktails late one evening, and we told the younger kids they had to bring the canoes back, and we were just laying in wait for them as they got near shore and just pummeled them with the water balloons.
That's where you could really, like, as adults, give it to the younger guys, because they've chosen to be there.
Yeah.
That's really funny. What a great legacy. And a lot of camps ended up copying it.
Yeah, we were, to the best of my knowledge, we were the first ones to do this.
To do an annual alumni weekend.
And for some of us now, it's just the best week of our summers.
I think what's really special about it, too, is over time, I don't know when this started, but people started bringing others that aren't Menominee alumni. They started, like, I brought my dad, and people bring their brothers or cousins or people that they think would just have a good time, and they end up making camp friends.
And now... I think this year in the picture with dads and their sons, I think we had about 50 or 60 guys in that picture.
Yeah.
And it'll be even more this year. And it's pretty cool to be there with your son.
Yeah, it's the multi-generational, it used to be just a handful, and now it's exploding. And that's kind of cool.
I think you were telling me we're going to have four or five more kids in the rookie fantasy camp. Yeah, it's a great long week.
The frontiersmen are going to, in the next few years, they're going to have to make a choice about whether to be the next dads.
Father and
dads.
Dad.
Yeah. Okay. And right around the same time, the Nate Wass Camp Fund started.
Yes.
So tell me about the origins of that.
Glenn approached me and said that he, through ACA, had learned that other camps had formed 501c3 organizations to help send more kids to camp, mm-hmm. and asked if I would be willing to do it. And I said yes, and got Bob Sachs and a few other gentlemen to assist. And we got a corporation formed and got our tax exempt status, and we went to work.
What year was this?
In the 80s.
Right around the time Fantasy Camp, yeah. All kind of happening around the same time.
I want to say Nate Wass is about 40 years old.
When did Nate pass?
I want to say in the 80s.
Okay. So this was kind of
Edna passed first.
Okay.
Then he remarried Selma. And he was up at camp with her. Then he had some health problems. But I was just trying to look that up. But I believe it was in the 80s.
Was he alive for this being named after him? Or no, probably just by a couple of years?
I don't think he was alive.
So the Nate Wass Camp Fund raises money to... Was it its original mission to help send families in our community to camp? Was it... a broad spectrum of let's raise money just to help families, any family that needs it?
We always sent kids to other camps. The majority went to Camp Menominee, but it was always our goal to help send kids to other camps. It was some traditional Northwoods camps, Miramita, and other camps like that. But we send kids to camps that had sight impairments, dealing with cancer issues, had lost their parents in war in the military. So over the years, we've sent a lot of kids to different types of camps.
And I think on average, the fund sends between 10 and 20 campers to camp every summer, which is a pretty special thing. And one of the first of its kind, too, at least in our private camping community.
Yeah, there were a few, and we modeled off those, but now more exist. But very proud of what my son and the new board has done.
Right, as everything, it's generational. So you started it, and were the president, and now your son Peter, who went to Menominee, is the president of the Nate Wass Fund. And we have a lot of like amazing people that are working hard on, now there's different events, and there's a lot that they do, and they're doing
a tremendous job generating a lot more money and sending a lot more kids to camp. Obviously, camp's more expensive, but there's a lot more need, and we've made a difference in kids' lives. I've had parents call me many, many years after their kids went to camp, or email me saying, "Steve, I just want to let you know what type of difference being able to send my kid to Camp Menominee made."
And a lot of them end up being counselors, and it's really special, because our camps are a cool thing, and they're getting more and more expensive and more important. And it's hard to reconcile those two things. And the Nate Fund really does a great job, and helps out in the community there. Okay. What time do we have to, I'm going to timestamp it. Okay. Then let's do, I'm going to look.
You look for a second. Let me throw out a couple things have been lost over the years.
Please.
Consular Twilight League softball.
Okay.
Back when we were CITs and JCs, there were enough consulars with softball acumen, not as many foreigners. And we had three teams and probably three rest periods each week. We'd have consular games. The kids would come out and watch us. We were pretty good athletes.
Was it mandatory for the kids to watch?
No.
Okay.
No. But if both your counselors were playing, your cabin had to be out there. So we would have nice crowds, and we'd be on what you call Bob Bender. That was Senior Diamond.
Okay.
And that lasted probably 5-7 years. But cool.
We do a counselor 16A game once or twice a year. Yeah. So there's something there. And in 2021, we gave the counselors a little outlet, and we did counselor sports. So we did basketball and softball and volleyball and flag football.
We had some random games. We never played Quagga in a counselor game that I can remember. Our first renewed interaction with Ojibwa was in the early 70s. We played a counselor game with them.
What sport do you remember?
16, softball. And we lost. I remember that. But that was the first interaction between the two camps in my era that we had. But that was a cool thing for those years. We had enough good athletes, and those were very competitive games. It was fun to watch. It was fun to play.
Were the rules the same?
16.
Yeah.
For the most part, it was unlimited arc.
Yeah. Steal first to second.
Hesitation. You could not steal unless they played
only
on
if
you.
The pitcher played.
Pitcher
on.
Played on,
yeah.
You. Yeah.
Same rules.
And there were guys, I haven't seen any guys recently hitting the cabins, but we had guys, lefties who could hit the cabins.
Yeah, it's rare.
9 and 10. And there was a guy before my era, Ray Benda, who could hit the woods over Diamond 2.
With a 16-inch?
With a 16-inch, I saw it.
So that's basically saying he could go out to Alois and hit a 16-inch out of the...
Yes.
I've never seen anyone do that. I've seen guys hit balls a long way, but never coming that close to clearing the Alois fence.
No, I saw Benda put him in the woods. The farthest I ever saw in a camper counselor environment was Glenn Klein's cousin hit a ball, and there was a tree that I think still there on the third baseline of Diamond 2.
Yeah.
And I caught a ball that he hit.
Past the third base.
Past the third base foul line.
Behind the scoreboard and the archery target.
Yes.
There. I mean, that's 350 feet, maybe, probably more.
No,
that's way more.
300, maybe.
You think so?
Yeah, I don't think it's 350.
That's a, yeah, it, I guess.
It was a good poke.
We'll have to measure it.
We should. That was the longest poke I ever saw. But the Counselor League were a cool thing growing up, and the kids still remember. They would come out and watch because it was good softball.
Give me your, like, either a brief story or a quick reaction or like a one or two sentence summary of each of these kind of camp legends. So we talked about Al Lewis. Jim Buzz Wyeth.
Jim was the tennis coach along with Bob Bender, and my activity, which I taught, was tennis. Jim taught me to be a very good tennis instructor, hopefully, but more importantly, taught me to be a better person. Jim was a class act. He was a good soul. We kept in contact during the school year. I've told the story that Jim was the tennis coach and a business teacher at Rantoul High School, and he had to go to the middle schools and literally find kids that wanted to learn how to play tennis. He would teach them how to play tennis as 7th and 8th graders so he could have a tennis team at Rantoul High.
And then eventually brought some of those kids to camp?
Brought some of those kids to camp, and they would teach tennis along with us.
Kaz. We haven't talked about Kaz.
Kaz showed up in 1969, a Wisconsin boy. Comes up. He's the same age as myself and Sachs and Backrack, Jeff Schwartz. And he was from a different place than we were. And 69... it was a transitional time in America between 66, where you went to college and you were wearing khakis and a blue shirt and got your hair cut every 4 weeks. By 69, people were wearing blue jeans, tie-dye shirts, and smoking marijuana. And
Kaz, are you telling me that's what Kaz was?
No, okay. Kaz was from... Wisconsin, and he came up, and he was Mr. Straight, but
not surprising.
He was a good guy, assimilated right in with us, and I spent 4 years on staff with Kaz.
Was he married those years? Because he got married very early on in life, like at 20 or 21, pretty much right out of college. He still kept coming back to camp.
He was not married in 69. I mean, we were 20 years old then.
Right. I think it was pretty close because I remember at his memorial service, they were talking about like how quickly he married Alice out of school.
I know he kept coming back to camp. I just don't remember when he got married.
How quickly did he make an imprint on camp? Like, was he one of those guys who was there and like, or did it take him some years to
a couple years? He was working the waterfront with Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And I forget when Lloyd stopped coming. I believe that was in the early 70s, and Kaz stepped right up, and he was a big personality, a good guy, well organized, nice guy.
Was he always Kaz? Like, was he always called Kaz?
He was always Kaz.
Okay. What about Bob Bender?
Great athlete, said that there was nobody in the world that could beat him in bowling, golf, and tennis, 2 out of 3. And he was probably pretty close to that. He was a real good tennis player, played center field and softball. We called him the bird. He would just go running from left field to right field. He'd always clap before he made the catch and bring the ball in. And a good golfer. I swear he had a hole in one during fantasy camp on the second hole, but it just didn't stay in the hole because the holes were so poor.
Did he keep going back to camp to help Glenn, or was he just there when you were there and made an impact?
Oh, he was there when I was there. He had come to camp
before,
and was there, then went away, and then came back.
Got it. All these people kept coming back to camp even after they were married and had kids, right? They kept coming back
Bob
to work.
Bob did. Yeah. Lloyd was never married. Buzz was never married. Okay. Buzz had been initially a counselor at Ojibwa.
Really?
And then came over.
Okay. We're getting down to... there's a different version. There's another episode of this that we'll do with your camp friends, with Jerry and with Bobby, to actually tell some of those stories and get your guys... memories jogged on some of the really fun stuff, but this has been great. Let's finish with a couple legacy things. When was the, for people that don't know, the Twilight League Championship Senior Trophy is named after you. When did that happen? It's the Steve Ehrlich Trophy. Do you remember when that happened?
No, and still don't know why, because I wasn't a softball counselor. They were nice enough to let me coach 13B every year, being a tennis counselor. And I had a little softball acumen, but and I enjoyed it, but I was a tennis guy.
So did Glenn name the trophy?
Yeah, Glenn did.
Did he
that.
Tell you he was doing it?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you feel good about that?
It was very nice, and it was very cool that Peter won it his senior year, so we had the Ehrlich Trophy at the Ehrlich House.
I would imagine that, so Glenn went on a run of naming, so he named the softball diamond after Bob Bender, the baseball field after Al Lewis, the rec hall after all of the Wassermans, the tennis courts after Buzz, so kind of honoring
Kaz's house
after Kaz, so maybe he kind of, all that stuff was taken, and here's the trophy for Twilight League. Did you all have a Twilight League trophy before that? Like, did the winners take home anything?
No, we, I think you got a patch.
Okay.
We had patches for a lot of stuff, and they went nowhere. You wouldn't put them on your five-year jacket. You just had patches. Initially, you had plaques, and in every sport, you would get tested, and you would get a bronze, silver, gold, or special, and you would put that on your plaque. And the goal was to always, you know, get the gold or special in each sport.
We're trying to do different versions of that and seeing what sticks with the kids, because I think that that growth and that acknowledgement is really important. Did y'all have 5-year jackets?
We had 5-year jackets. I still have mine from 1964. It's very tattered. It was beige with Camp Menominee and script over the left breast.
Were they all the same, or did every class have a different jacket?
They, for the most part, were the same.
Did you do any other loyalty things? Was there a 10-year big deal? Was there, or was it really just 5 years?
I think there was 5 years. Then they started 2 years, either with a hat or something like that. Remember, you didn't, you could buy Menominee sportswear in the city, but...
Right, you had to go to a store that made it, probably.
Marshall Fields or something,
yeah.
And you would get that, but press-on letters, that did not come until about 1964, which was the origin of the Purple Gang.
Right.
We were on our town trip, and we got purple T-shirts with the word purple on it. And Terry Davis, one of our campers, it was, I think, a song by Roger Miller, Dang Me, Purple and Maple Circle or something. So we started with purple, and we had gone into town first, being the senior cabin. Every cabin got their own color. There was an orange cabin, a yellow cabin, but we sort of stuck as the purple gang.
Purple became your thing. And that, like, kind of started the whole, like, now that's a thing. Every age group likes to name themselves and have an identity and have things that are associated with them. It's kind of nice.
But that was our senior cabin in 64. We had one of the mixers with Maramita was Carnival. And every other year, you would be at Maramita or Menominee, and our year, senior year, was at our place, so we'd had Purple Land and had all these games, but we made a big deal of the purple thing.
Did Peter, your son, have a choice in where to go to camp?
Yeah, or, Menominee.
Right. He had the one choice of Menominee. That was ingrained in him.
Well, he started, I think, his first year, he was 2 years old.
So, yeah, that helps. All right, let's talk about the meat man. Was the meat man a legend? Was it a legendary story when you were at camp, or was he there?
No, it was before my time.
It was before your time.
Scary stories were just part of going to camp. And whether it be who stole the golden arm.
What's the golden arm?
You've never heard Who Sold My Golden Arm?
No.
Oh.
That's another story.
That went away. But let's go back to the meat man, because that's the one that everyone knows and talks about.
So counselors would, you know, tell you stories before you went to bed and probably kept some kids up all night. But the meat man was the Menominee story about a gentleman who comes into camp going to the freezer in the back of the mess hall and taking the meat. So he became known as the meat man. Well, eventually one night they set up a trap to catch the meat man. And they had counselors with guns and knives. And he gets in, he's coming out with the meat, and they wound him. And they follow him out of the mess hall to the front door, and he goes into cabin 3, takes a kid, is dragging the kid.
This is horrible.
To Old Counselor's Road. There, they're able to shoot him again. He drops the kid, thankfully, heads down Old Counselor's Road. They follow the trail of blood into the woods on the right-hand side of Old Counselor's Road, heading towards the highway. And then the track goes cold. And the next day they come out and they try to find him, and they could not find him. But as the legend goes, he died somewhere in the woods. He's under the leaves on the east side of Old Counselor's Road. And so when we would then go on sneak outs, they would assign each cabin a night to sneak out of camp, to go down towards Pitlick. On the other side of Pitlick's was a lodge called Wauwatosa, or Watosa Lodge, and they had sodas and candy bars, and you would think you're sneaking out with no one knowing. Al, Nate knew what you were doing. You would sneak out, and they, all the counselors would arrange to have other counselors in the woods making noises, and it would be the ghost of the meat man.
So all the sneak outs back then were meat man centric.
Yeah.
Got it.
Because the meat man was out in the woods, had never been found.
Now, people like to say that when you walk out of the mess hall, the picture of Doris and two male chefs, that one of them is the meat man. Who are the people with her?
That's Kurt and Al. Kurt was the longtime cook who cooked at Camp Menominee during the summers and cooked at the ZBT house at the University of Wisconsin during school year. Kurt was Arnie Freeman and other guys. He was there during my era in the 60s, cooking as the chef at the fraternity house. I'm not sure what Al did during the school year. I think he was a baker, and I think he was from up north somewhere. But neither of those were the meat man. That was Kurt Niels, Kurt and Al. And the cheer used to be at the end of a great meal is yay or rah, Kurt and Al. And Kurt would always come out with a big knife and wave and wave it around in recognition of the guys cheering for him. And Al didn't speak. He was a mute, and he would just come out and wait. But Kurt always came out with basically a hatchet swinging it around.
So do we know if the meat man was based on an actual, like, not a real story at camp, of course, but an actual chef or a cook that we had?
No.
Okay.
This was a common criminal.
Do we know if it came from another camp, the origin of it at Menominee?
I do not know where it started, but if I had to guess, it came from,
a creative counselor.
Some counselor who had been another camp or as a counselor or as a camper and had come up with that tale.
That's great.
Well, Who Stole the Golden Arm is about a guy who had a gold mine, and he gets injured, and they make a gold prosthesis of his arm. Well, lo and behold, someone steals his arm. And the counselor's telling the story, embellishing it, and he's walking around, and people, he's just saying, who stole my golden arm? And he repeats it and repeats it like 20, 30, 40 times. Finally, he goes, "Who stole my golden arm?" And he jumps on one of the kids and scares the bejesus out of him.
Yeah, that is never, I've never even, that's the first time I've ever
You've never heard the golden arm?
No, never heard it. All right, I think we got to wrap up for now. I mean, there's so much we didn't necessarily get to, but let's end on this. This is Camp's 97th year. We're a couple years away from the 100th. For people that are out there that want to get involved or want to be a part of it, let's give them advice on how to reconnect with us.
We're going to be getting out a Menominee megaphone in the not too distant future. What we're going to need is everyone to update their information. And more importantly, we're going to need you to look through what is a fairly large list of lost alumni,
yes.
Alumni for whom we do not have email addresses, literally hundreds of alumni. With thanks to Jason's staff, we went through a lot of megaphones and found names that were missing from the alumni database and what years they were at camp, but we do not have contact information. So we're going to need your help in helping us find fellow campers and counselors, and we will be providing information how you can tell us if you would be interested in helping us organize what is going to be a series of events and activities celebrating the centennial of Camp Menominee.
Yes, we will need you to volunteer your time to either help organize an event or find people or gather information. It's going to take a community effort to get there for sure.
Let me give a shout out to my folks for sending me to camp, to Nate and Al for having Menominee there for myself and all the campers and counselors that had an opportunity to go to Camp Menominee, and to Glenn and to Steve and to Jason for keeping the campfires burning, to Nate Now, or Kurt Now, for feeding me for many, many years. We haven't talked about kitchen staff.
No, we didn't get into the unsung
Doris
heroes.
And that whole group. I mean, that's just talking about camp food would be...
Oh, there's so many more things about how they train the staff and the unsung heroes and all of that stuff that we didn't get into, but we'll have plenty of time to
Denoyers, camp sneakouts, pit licks, a lot of the traditions, all camp squirt gun fights, Message Garcia.
It is cool to know that these things go back that far. And just the history of this stuff is not, people don't really talk about it that much, and they assume that camp was camp, but it evolves a lot.
Just what events are not in the all camp relay now, and why they are not in the all camp relay.
I found an all camp relay from the 8, Lloyd sent me one from the 70s or maybe the 80s, and I compared it to now. Most are still in there, plus a lot more. I mean, ours is I think it's 52 relay events, maybe more.
We had high jumping.
Oh, we don't do high jumping.
We had chin-ups.
We do.
Chin-ups came out after one kid did too many practice ones and couldn't do them.
Oh,
and,
really?
And we didn't have a max time. For
so
events,
just standing there,
it killed them.
I mean, yeah, we could do a whole hour long podcast on every relay event and stories from each one. Which maybe we'll get into later. But thanks for sitting down with me. Thank you for it. The only reason any of this works is because people like yourself and alumni who have a passion for this stay connected and stay involved and raise money and organize the things that those of us who are running camp don't have time to. And you're the thread that keeps it all together. So for everyone out there that wants to get back into it and get involved, please reach out because there's plenty of ways.
See you at Fantasy Camp.
See you at Fantasy Camp. For Steve and for the love of camp, I'm Jason Fogreber. We'll see you next time.